Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We are a group of dedicated thinkers who come together to consider ancient ideas collectively, but to independently work on a deeper understanding of them and our relation to each other and all of life. This is the tie that binds all ULTs around the world, however situated. There is no fee, there are no bylaws. This is independent work done in a collective manner. To be considered a theosophist, one would be working in the service of humanity in whatever form they saw fit. The end in view being to become better able to offer assistance or to teach as we learn from others. This work is enormous, deep, eternal, and it is said will not overwhelm the understanding of a child, as these ideas are actually a part of our very nature. So we offer them for consideration twice weekly in the current cycle, Sunday mornings from 10, doors open at 10:30, we meet from 11 till noon. Wednesdays, the doors open at 5:30, and the reference library is open from 5:30 to 7:30. The meeting runs from 7:45 till 9 p.m. Before and after all meetings, the book table is open in the center of the building, where we offer straight-line theosophical teachings from the original founders who were passing on the message from ancient sages. And we do that simply at the cost of printing and shipping. The Lodge gathers no funds, makes no requirement, but rather sustains itself entirely on voluntary contributions from its associates. So if you are so moved to volunteer your time, your service, or your money, and even a dollar goes a long way to keep the lights on and the heat and so forth, anything offered is done right at this branch, and you can speak to the person at the book table. Wednesday evenings, we're studying a book called The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, and this coming Wednesday, we will be starting Chapter 5, and we are talking through the constitution of man and his place in evolution. On Sundays, we have a monthly topic, and believe it or not, next Sunday begins a new month, the last month of this year. And the monthly topic is cycles and cyclic law, and the topic specifically for next Sunday will be working with the law of cycles. And if it's your first time with us, all meetings have a presentation and then time for questions and discussion. So this morning, our topic is the allegory of Plato's cave. And to give you just a little bit of background, Plato was a Greek philosopher alive in the 3rd and 4th centuries BC. Probably one of the greatest philosophers of our time, and one whose complete works is available to us, yet we are told some of the works that bear his name are not necessarily his teachings, so we must seek them out. Plato wrote dialogues rather than philosophical treatises, and these dialogues never contained himself as a character because he didn't want to tell his readers what to think. He offered these ideas as a way of folks questioning for themselves and learning for themselves. Socrates taught us to doubt and question and learn through the assumption that we don't know the answer, but Plato then took his teachings in a different direction. He helped pave the path that we follow, even today in these rooms, in our endless search for truth. He asks us to descend from universal ideas to particulars in our search and to use this insight we gain in the process of becoming aware of cosmic evolution to derive lessons for our personal and social life. So the Hermetic phrase, as above, so below, certainly fits these teachings. Now, the allegory of the cave is in Book 7 of the masterwork, The Republic, and the general work centers on a simple question: is it always better to be just than unjust? And the specific question addressed in the allegory of the cave is whether the mind is enlightened or unenlightened, its condition, and how it and spirit can be realized, shall we say. In this dialogue, Socrates is speaking to Glaucon, another character in the dialogue, and the translation in popular use, just for your information, is by Benjamin Jowett, who is a professor of Greek studies. It's a widely accepted translation of the ancient Greek. So it starts with the idea that human beings are living in an underground den, what we might call a cave, which has a mouth open towards the light, and they are sitting chained from childhood, legs, arms, neck, they can't move. Behind them and raised up is a burning fire. Then there is a low wall, and it is said that the wall of the cave they are facing has the shadows from the fire behind them of anything moving in front of it. So through their lives, what they have seen on this wall has been everything they have experienced. So they consider this to be true, these shadows. And whether it's people walking by, carrying things, animals, whatever the shapes are, they are identified and held to be the true form because it's all they can apprehend. They have no ability to look or consider beyond what's in front of them. So the question is put, what would happen if the chain was loosened and one was able to turn and look towards the fire? Well, the first thing that would happen would be pain, the intense pain in the eyes, because we go from shadow to light quickly. And it would take time for that acclimation. And certainly, originally, that one would say, that's false. What I have seen here, these shadows are what's true. That's what I know. So the eye is turned then towards the light, towards real existence, but the soul in that moment can't figure out what's going on. So if he is then compelled to look straight at the light, straight at the fire, the pain in his eyes will be so much he'll be forced to turn away. And then the idea is considered that let's drag him up out of the cave, out into the light. Well, you can imagine coming from darkness to bright sunlight, the intense pain in the eyes, and one would cower and shelter and be irritated by this, be dazzled by the brilliant sunlight. And it would take quite a while to become accustomed to this new world. And it's said, at first, such a one would only be able to see shadows as the eyes were becoming accustomed. Second, the reflections, perhaps in water, reflections of men and objects. And then finally be able to see the objects themselves and perhaps the stars and moon and the night sky. After much time, one would be able to see the sun, and it is said at that moment he would see a reflection of himself in the water for the first time, be able to see, this is me, and at that moment will contemplate his place in the universe. At that point, it would be perhaps a false sense of, I have created all of this. I am responsible for all of this. And remembering his old habitation in the den, in the cave, he would pity those souls. They're lost in the darkness. They think these shadows are real. What a shame. He would feel pity for them, and better to be a poor servant of a poor master and endure anything than to think and live as they do. He would shun them, in a sense. Well, now suppose he's forced back into the cave, back into the old way of perception. Once again, that disorientation. He can't perceive anything, and the ones who haven't moved are then laughing at him. You can't even see the shadows. What's wrong? So there is this question of how do we come out of the shadows into the light? What happens along that journey, and what will be the result? So the second half will go into the underlying ideas of that allegory.
Well, just as Buddha is considered to be the full blossom of Eastern thought, so too is Plato viewed as the fullest blossom of Western thought. And this system that he offers of spiritual allegories or spiritual myths is timeless because they are a collection of archetypal ideas that can be applied to individuals, to the entire human race, to a given day, to the descent of the soul, and even to politics. He would even apply, and we can apply these even to politics. He was able to do this. You know, it is said that he is a self-evolved fifth rounder, which is to say he is evolved far beyond what the human race is at this stage of the game. Consequently, when he wrote his myths and allegories, the extent to which they were accepted and recognized, relatively speaking, was very, very little. And it wasn't for yet a few hundred years thereafter that he was more fully appreciated by the Neoplatonists, who read and wrote and taught systematically what Plato was able to really offer mankind. Now, how does the cave impart spiritual truths to the reader? A group of people chained to the cave, watching shadows on the wall. How does it impart truths to the reader? Who among us shows in our thoughts and actions a refusal to recognize that we live in a condition that corresponds to that very cave? Or are we willing to say that we know everything that we observe, and we know the full truth of everything that we perceive? Are we willing to step out and say that, or are we going to acknowledge first, you know what, in certain ways, we all live in our own cave, individually and collectively. There must be more out there that I can understand or that I can perceive, and am I willing to do the things necessary to take the steps toward that understanding and wisdom? To realize the distinction, we're told, to realize the distinction that, I might be in the cave, and there are those who are, through their intuition and their understanding and their own personal effort, there are those along the path who are ahead of where I am. That right there is a big step in the direction that we're talking about along the path, just to acknowledge that there's a distinction between those in the cave and that those who are in the cave can do something about it. Are we willing to accept the idea that our perception of the truth is little more but those shadows of reality that Plato's actors, so to speak, are seeing? As was described, the shadows that are going on in front of them is all that they know. And so their development is one in which they would compete to try to figure out what it is first, and the person who got it right first was held higher in greater distinction in a level of hierarchy than the ones who didn't. How important is that? In his allegory, right, so in his allegory, the prisoners are bound by chains. If they were released from those chains by somebody else, by an external agency, by a friend who's further along the path, or by a savior God, if they were to be released from these chains, when they got up from where they were, would they still be able to understand the higher realities if somebody else released them? Theosophy would say certainly not, because part of the reason why we are where we are is because we created it for ourselves. There are opportunities to learn from wherever we are and to grow, whether it's spiritually, intellectually, to emotionally refine ourselves, requires that we develop muscles in according to that nature, and to break the chains that are holding us down. If we don't develop muscles to break the chains, if we don't develop in certain ways so that we're able to perceive accurately on higher in higher ways, in higher planes of truth, then if we end up there anyway, we're in trouble, because now we're in a world where we don't understand anything, and there's more power and there is therefore more danger. So one should not be released from the chains by someone else. Rather, he should work to do what he needs to do to grow out of those chains and break them himself. Now, then we could talk about the self-liberated prisoner, he who has done the work to break those chains, because he has done the work required to grow. The self-liberated prisoner would remember his old habitation. He would remember the situation that his brother prisoners were in, and he may well pity them, and he might even take some kind of personal pride in the advancements that he's made, because he's done what he needs to do to get out of there. But the journey of the individual who has broken the chains is representative of the advance of the soul. And when we have made a step forward along the path, certain tests present themselves to us, and we'll just finish it up with this, we don't want to go over time. One test is that he must become accustomed to his new addition, to his new conditions. So just like when we walk out into the light of day, best not to walk out of a dark building into the light, right into the street, because our eyes have to adjust to the light. So there's this adjustment that needs to happen so that he can accurately perceive that which he has earned. And next, he must recognize and accept the unity of all things. Well, why is this a test? Why is this a test? We'll talk about that in a minute. He must recognize the unity in all things, especially if he is following the path of renunciation. Third, he must show compassion to his brother prisoners, rather than basking in his own accomplishment. And fourth, he must detach from false estimations of value. What was important to him and to his brother prisoners at a time, such as figuring out what the shadow was and gaining respect for that is all for naught at his stage of the game. So he has to detach himself from those types of from what was important to him. Finally, should his duty necessitate him to re-enter the cave? Should our duty necessitate us to go back to an environment where we were, perhaps to be to give assistance to those who were there? He has to accept the fact that his brothers may and often would reject him and reject his ideas. They still cling to his former delusions, and they would say that he had become blind to their reality when actually the opposite is true, and he should never even have considered ascending. He should not dare to free another. They would say he should not dare to free another to lead them to the light. Now this brings us back to, why must he accept the unity of all? Well, if he has, the individual who has worked to develop in him the recognition of the universality of brotherhood, then when he descends into the lower conditions and he's persecuted or is just leading a life of toil, if he is able to bring with him that idea that we are all one and hold on to it, regardless of the conditions, then that is the light that is going to lead him through the conditions should he forget who he is while he's there. And that's representative of really the toil of the entire human race. So we'll stop there. There's other ideas, but we don't want to go over. So please, yes.
What practical application does this allegory have for us today? What could we use that in? What would that help us in our everyday life?
See, that's just that there are so many ways that it can apply. Let's just take a high school student who graduated and comes back for homecoming. When he comes back and he's gone on to college, hopefully he's come back and is meeting with his old friends who are still in high school, who may or may not follow in his footsteps. But if he, say, he got into the Ivy League, would he come back and encourage others to do as he's done if that's an important goal? You see what we're saying? Or is he going to come back so he can party with his old friends and get high with them again? You know, so there's a big difference based on whether or not he's really broken the chains of the limitations of the high school life. Another example really could be in politics. People in politics, when they, I don't say, well, let's not say any one country, but you have a low level of government, people rise above according to, you'd think and we'd hope, according to the ethical work that they do, and because they become more able to be of service to humanity, they are given more power. Well, if they've risen above those chains because someone wrote a check to get the politician where he is, he's never really developed the muscles to be of greater service. And everyone suffers then, because we've got a person in a position making decisions who lacks the wisdom to do it, because he actually hasn't worked his way there, hence the money. Any ideas?
On a metaphysical basis, we're told that Plato used allegory and myth for two reasons: to awaken the mind, or manas, and to arouse the buddhi, or intuition, of everyone who hears them. So this idea of being accustomed to discerning shadows as the real reminds us that the ideas we hold need to be looked at. Are they simply reflections of what we've heard year after year and told were true, or have we come away from them into a different condition or perception and prove them for ourselves? Can we say, I have looked directly on them with the light of mind and discerned the truth within them?
Yes, in the middle.
So basically, it's really about the ideas that we hold. That is what changes to the wall, and we therefore only see the reflection of the real, and that our ignorance is the darkness in which we live. So, I mean, the allegory goes on and on and on, how we can apply it to ourselves, and from our awakening into the true light of the spirit, mm-hmm. or soul.
We left a quote just outside the room, if you care to take it with you, from The Secret Doctrine, and it also has one from Plato just beneath it, so bear with us. As we rise in the scale of development, we perceive that during the stages through which we passed, we mistook shadows for realities, and the upwards progress of the ego is a series of progressive awakenings. Each advance bringing with it the idea that now at last we have reached reality. But only when we shall have reached the absolute consciousness and blended our own with it, shall we be free from the delusions produced by Maya. And in Plato's words, very simply, those having lamps will pass them on to others.
There's a hand here.
What would be the responsibility of a person who has used his muscles to get out of the shadows of the cave if everyone must use their own muscles to achieve this? What responsibilities would someone on the outside coming back have? How far would they need to go, or should they go, in helping this person use their own muscles to come out?
So what's the responsibility of those who have freed themselves? Well, certainly the responsibilities and the duties of that individual is going to have to be discerned by him. And it really depends on what path he's on. There are two paths. One is the path of liberation, and the other is that of renunciation. The path of liberation, one who follows the path of liberation, once he has freed himself from those chains, he has done so by his own efforts. He lives in harmony with the universe. He evolves in such a way that at some point in time he has risen in consciousness and everything else so that his karma is satisfied and he has the opportunity to enter into eternal bliss for the rest of the great Manvantaric period. That is the path of liberation. The path of renunciation is the path that is taught by the teachers of theosophy. And that path simply is that whatever the effect of the causes I set in motion, I will observe them, but I will not put these causes in motion so that they will come back round and help me personally. Rather, I will work so that I can be of greater service to all of creation until all of creation has reached a full collective liberation. So in that sense, there's a certain responsibility to know how much is too much to be of service to others, and thus they don't develop in ways that they otherwise would because we're doing the work for them, versus how much can I do for all of humanity? Am I doing enough? I can always do something more. So one must grow in wisdom, and one, just as perhaps the individual on the path to liberation, it may be an easier path because he's got to focus on himself. The path of renunciation is a path where the end in view is the unity, the collectivity, the oneness of all of life, and we have to work for that. So we develop, either we develop our muscles in a different way, or we develop different muscles in higher ways, but the end result is that our goal should be to be of service to help and teach universally. And part of that is knowing when to hold and knowing when to fold, knowing when to help and knowing when to step back. And certainly there's no outside authority who's going to dictate or write a book and give a formula for how that works. It really is a matter of intuition, which will come to the fore of those who follow this path, this selfless path of renunciation.
So perhaps be ready and willing to assist while each makes himself able.
So to reaching that goal of renunciation would depend on much they want to learn, how much they want to know, how anxious they are to learn what's beyond the shadow, basically.
Certainly. Okay, so the contribution here is it'll, how much we can help another really depends on how much another wants to be helped. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink it. And, well, you know, theosophy is not for everybody in necessarily in this life, in everyone's stage of condition, but who's to say when or how those conditions will change? So we're encouraged to promulgate, plant the seeds, and be available for those which sprout, for those who come, not to evangelize, but to be available for those who seek. Yes?
A simple rule is be ready to share. Share books, if that's what the other needs. Share the ideas that you have begun to assimilate. So it's to give from what you have, and that's easy.
Mm-hmm. One interesting example of that that just happened over the weekend was, relatives are in from all over, and we have a cousin who's more like a nephew. He's young, he's in college, but he was brought up systematically as the perfect young Catholic student. And he is able to speak philosophically on a level of Catholicism that I haven't seen from anyone other than a professor. And he started speaking about the is the Trinity, are they consubstantial or not? And the Church teaches that they are consubstantial, which is the antithesis of the ancient teachings. And it's a dangerous thought to get everybody thinking in that through generations and centuries. Well, the reason why we bring this up is we found it kind of profound that in our discussion with him, this was the first discussion that he ever had with someone who was able to clearly explain to him the difference between the two and which seems true to you. Because all along, the truth to him was consubstantiality of the Trinity. And when the idea was presented of how that's dangerous, that was the first time he ever really heard about it, you know? And theoretically, he said, well, he accused me of being a Gnostic and a pagan. And I was like, right, and a heretic. But it helped, but it gave him food for thought. Who knows what he's going to do with it? Anyway.
And along those lines, whatever plane our consciousness may be acting in at any given time, both we and the things belonging to that plane are, for the time being, our only realities. So as wrapped up as we are in the ideas we hold to be true, we can either see and consider something else or not as we see fit. So we may be offering the loftiest ideas we can, but the other is bound for the moment in the belief that they have. And not until that position changes are we able to affect that all.
And not until he's presented with a balancing idea on that lofty plane, does he have an option? You know, because it's just not. There's been a hand way in the back for a while, yeah. And then this.
And in regards to the assistance, if somebody's coming from the outside into the cave, we would think that in some respects, if those people are in the cave and all they're seeing are all the shadows, what would be the impetus? What would push them to think, well, maybe there's something more out there? It's like some of the natives in Africa. They don't know anything about what's outside their boundaries. So what would make them want to think that maybe there's more? Whereas if somebody is coming in, and as was said, you know, offering that there is an alternative, then they would be able to make a choice depending upon where they are, if they're going to take that lead or not. But, you know, we would think that in some respects, that having somebody come in would be helpful. rather than it them not learning on their own because maybe they don't know that there is anything out there.
Sure, and that but that person who comes in, who would be helpful, comes in at the right time under law, at a certain level of development where they may be more open to new ideas. And so that's an allegory for the Nirmanakaya, for the saviors of civilizations. And there's been a hand right here.
Just real quickly, though. Plato says in this treatise, our argument shows that the power and capacity of learning exists in the soul already. So he goes on to say this turning from darkness to light is actually the progression towards good, and in the world of knowledge, the idea of good appears last of all and is seen only with effort. So there has to be, as we've heard before, some dissatisfaction with the present condition before there is the impetus to change it. And at some point that happens.
And an example, a practical example of that out in the world is there are plenty of people, good, honest, pious people who follow the traditions of any of the world's religions and live an ethical life and can do so. But there are those who sometimes, although they follow that path, they want to understand a little more. They hear certain things that don't make sense and they want answers to those bigger questions that are asked, because they're starting to discern that those answers aren't fitting the bill. And so they begin to grow out of that tradition in search of the truth, which may be able to be found in the tradition if they find the right people, but maybe not. So, yes, in the back.
But also in this allegory is a lesson that embedded in human nature, in the higher, in the Buddhi nature, there are certain impulses, there are certain intuitions that exist, whether one is chained in a cave or released for a while and put back in again, regardless of what the conditions are, that natural impulse and potentiality is within. So that arises, and it's almost a magnetic effect, isn't it? That arises in frustration or in a moment of clear seeing or a moment of remission from whatever conditions are. And then that potentiality, that conditionality is opening to sensing and interpreting new information. Even calls forth new information.
Thank you. So the potentiality is within every individual. And it's a matter, according to the individual's karma, where they will become dissatisfied with the conditions around and reach for more. Thank you. Yes, right here.
Well, just to make a comment, you can reject the questions that arise and still be satisfied with your life. These questions may arise naturally because the human being, for some reason, wants to progress and express his potential. But you have a choice of rejecting that questions, those questions, or and staying where you are, conscious or unconscious level.
It depends, we think, absolutely. You have the potential of changing your mind at any given time. You have the potential of staying right where you are. It depends on, as Plato said, where you have placed your focus. And yes, you can consider lofty ideas and put them aside. Many, many folks have come into these rooms, heard these ideas and left them. We've never seen them again. The ideas then are implanted somewhere, but it isn't the time for them to bloom. So you can certainly continue on your life the best way you know how and be living a fruitful, decent life. It's also, this is all a matter of ethics. And the turning to help another is also part of that impacted wisdom in the essence, very essence of our inner nature. So that impetus to bloom, to do more, to be of service, will eventually arise It's whether we get out of our own way, in a sense, or whether we stay right where we are. We can continue to do that. Now, there's a whole class coming up on karma and cycles, and we can talk more about that next week.
Now, along that same line, a person who comes to these meetings and finds an incredible opportunity to learn and get questions answered, it may not be the right time for them, because if that person is a mother of four and works, she's got things to do, yet she may hold this in her mind and know or understand the amount of work that it takes and want to do it, so that eventually when the cycle is right for her, that she can take on this kind of work, she'll be all the more ready for it. And who's to say it may not have been the right time for her when she first met it, because there are certain muscles that she needed to develop. So that's not to say she hasn't been growing in certain ways behind the scenes. We couldn't say. You know, we just couldn't say.
That hand was up.
Yes.
The whole
yeah, yeah, right.
I wanted to go back as far as the not realizing that there are alternatives to the way we live. That not only occurs in Africa, that occurs in industrial societies, advanced industrial societies. Large segments of the population don't understand that there are alternatives to the way that they live. And further back, when we're speaking about helping people along, there's a very good illustration of that in the Sermon on the Mount. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus addressed the multitudes first, but then he took his disciples or his chelas, those who had prepared themselves, around to a smaller spot, making sure that there was no one to hear what he had to tell them, because he had special instructions for them, because they had prepared themselves for these special instructions. And the last thing I'd like to say is that we talk about people going back into the cave to release someone from the cave, or not going back in, but a person
to be of service
going into the cave to release it. But in many of the religious circles, there's a quote that says, God raised up one from among them. And what that means is, if an outsider comes and tells you, you can always say, well, he knows nothing of my problems, he's from across the way. But if it's from your neighbor next door, he knows your problems because he suffers the same. So often you find that the person who is raised up is a person like yourself that knocks the first leg from under your argument.
Thank you. And as we said, these universal archetypes can be applied to so many different scenarios. A perfect example is we had a group of young men in North Philadelphia who were high school students, and on a regular basis we would bring in highly accomplished professionals who were graduates of the same school. And this is some tough stuff. This, you think the cave is tough, this place in North Philly. But these alumni would come back and do what? Inspire. They would set the example. They would answer questions. Would the alumni come back and take the math tests for the students? No. Would they come back and give a false graduation certificate? Of course not. But that they would come back and be an inspiration, it's exactly the same idea.
And as to the comment about how the ideas are transmitted, Plato and his friends and fellow philosophers were transmitting this ancient mystical knowledge. These were the mystery schools of the time. Those who were interested would gather. Not all of Greece would gather to hear these ideas. Theosophy is a modern day mystery school. There are 15 or 18 people in the room. There are millions of people outside the door. So it's the awakening within that there is more to life. There is the seeking for the knowledge, and the practical application, as was said, is to bloom where you are planted. We can affect everything and everyone around us. So start the day with a good idea for the neighborhood, for the family, for the nation, for the world. Hold the idea that there is hope, there is compassion, there is peace, and those vibrations are felt so we can begin to affect all of life around us.
I think it's very important to remember that the person in the worst situation who knows the least about any of this is also identical to Plato as we are. The ones who have come, Buddha, Plato, Christ, have all come for the very same reason. They are identical to us. They know it and we don't. And they want to help us out of the cave. They want to awaken us. So when we're looking and making natural comparisons, we have to remember it's a question of the situation the soul is in, the instrument they're using, but within the potential, identical. We are identical to Plato. We're just asleep.
Thank you. There's a hand here.
The people in the cave, you know, they're looking at the shadows, but the shadows is not the real self. They're looking at a shadow of the self.
They're looking at a shadow of other objects. They're not even seeing the self.
They're not even seeing the self.
They're seeing shadows of something that the real form is here. There's a light behind the form, and there's a shadow of the form showing up, and that's what they see, and they think that's the form.
They think that's reality.
The theory of forms, right? Yeah.
They're thinking that's reality, and this person that escaped was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's coming back and telling them.
Who grew out of it? He didn't just escape. He
grew
out of
it.
Yes. Okay.
And he's coming in and telling them that this is not real.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And they don't want to believe that because they want to stay in safety.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Exactly.
It's been real all their life.
Mm-hmm.
Familiar.
That's familiar. So I guess he has no choice but to come back. But how does he get them out of that? That's a tough task to do.
How does he get them out? Well, those chains that are binding the prisoners, they are the chains of our passions and desires, binding our mind into physical existence, convincing us that this is the reality, and the temporal pleasures that we experience from stuff of the physical world, so many of us, broadly speaking, accept that is the reality. Who's going to come and tell any person who is so attached to this physical life, who has little or no idea of the spiritual life, who's going to come and tell them what to think and how to think it? It would take manipulation. It's something that has to grow from within. We can't. That person may come and live in such a way and set examples and answer questions if they come along, but he can't. No one can free you. No one can free another from their own personal attachments unless the individual makes the personal decision to work in that direction.
But understand, you don't need to walk into the cave for that. We are walking around, bound and clinging to the ideas that we give force and effect to. We are those prisoners bound by the chains of what we believe to be true. Theosophy says, examine it, consider it, study it, test it, give it force, give it practice, see if it fits, see if you can make a correspondence to it somewhere. If none of those things hold, release that chain. That chain is an untrue idea, and use that newly found movement to consider something different.
Yes.
But the one who escapes or grows out of the cave, they do have a choice. If they decide not to go back, I don't want to be around those ignorant people. They're going to defile me. They're going to bring me down. They're going to hold me back. We can look at that as the path of liberation. One who seeks for their own personal salvation or their own edification or illumination, whatever words you want to use. But the one who sees and feels with the heart, really, who really feels in the heart the need that these people are just like me. And for whatever reason, I was able to see a chink in the wall, and I could begin to see the light of reason, and it grew and it grew, and it can grow and become a flame. So I need to go back and see what I can do and forget about my own salvation, because this is a greater need. It's the heart that really brings one back to work with those that are in the cave and suffering and ignorance.
And the perfect practical example for that perhaps would be Harriet Tubman.
Yeah.
Yes.
Harriet Tubman. Just one point. We have always found Plato very difficult to read, to completely comprehend. And not until we came to theosophy did we really know or understand that this philosophy is expounded in the Bhagavad Gita. This is the same philosophy that Pythagoras and Plato and Ammoniasakis and Plotinus, all of them taught were the Orphic mysteries. And the Bhagavad Gita is the philosophy of Orpheus and how we can get out of that cave, and how we can, by giving us the right ideas, we can change our lives.
And Plato said, a few may be called to the pursuit of spiritual truth so that many may be aroused out of their state of slavery and delusion.
It's the slavery of the body.
Slavery.
This body is the slave.
Actually,
it's also the vehicle.
Right, the slavery is the false idea, the false ideas that attach us to the body and that cause us to identify ourselves with the body. If we simply view our body as the thing that I use to operate in this world, and therefore I must take care of it, I have a duty to take care of it to be of service to others, that's one way to look at it. So many of us look in the mirror and accept that, which is the shadow, as the reality. The reality of the individual is the soul and the efforts and the ideas that the soul has to be of service to others.
Is it getting the ego out of the way so you can do this?
Getting the personal ego out of the way. Thank you. Yeah.
But the body and the personal nature is also a two-edged sword, which is why we make a mistake when we judge ourselves and others. The instrument we have created is not representative of ourselves as spiritual beings. It's a temporary condition
mm-hmm.
that we can alter and fix. It is a cave, and we have to work to help others while at the same time perfecting some of the conditions that we find ourselves in. We think the important thing is don't judge. The dumbest person you meet might be the most brilliant, but their instrument isn't letting them work through it. So we have to be kind, even to ourselves.
Even to ourselves, yes. if anything, you know, many times judging ourselves is often we are guilty of. Yes.
I don't know whether Plato. I surmise he doesn't do this, but I'm not sure. Is there a dialogue? I think of hypothetically a dialogue among these people who are chained in their ignorance looking at the shadows. And I'm just fantasizing, thinking here, if there is each one free to pursue his own individual self where he is at that moment? Or is there a danger of being influenced by the input from other people who are contaminated as much as you are?
Is there a danger from watching television 30 hours a week?
Yeah.
We are independent thinkers, however, so we can allow ourselves to be influenced by what we hear and see and what others think, or we can decide to check for ourselves whether what we hear and see is true. We can stay dazzled for as long as we care to from whatever the mode is, television or whatever it is, that has got us glamored, or an idea that has allowed us to stay stuck and sort of blindly enamored with or desirous of keeping that, or at some point we can decide to step out of that cave or that binding force, whatever it may be, and say, let me see what else there is.
Yes?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, what was just stated is all perception. We perceive based on past experiences. But another allegory is one we heard years ago, where these blind men were put on different sides of an elephant. Mm-hmm. And they were able to describe with certainty that, you know, if one felt the leg and the size of it, and another one felt the trunk, there was an argument there, because that was all that they could perceive. So your perceptions have to be broader and be willing to take on an idea that somebody has, and you can't just dismiss it without thinking about it.
Thank you. And that comment was started with, we perceive things based on what we've learned in the past. And that's dangerous. That's dangerous. If we were to approach every new idea and weigh it against all the false ideas and see, well, which one weighs more, well, if there's more false idea, rather than look on the idea itself, give it its own, estimate the value of the idea based on using it, testing it, checking, talking to others who are like-minded. And if we do that with every person and everything that we do, gee whiz, there are biases and prejudices that may well just disintegrate simply because of our unwillingness to accept the illusions of the past. Yes?
We were thinking that since the necks are chained, they must not be able to see each other in the cave.
No.
First of all, if they could see each other, they would realize there's something other than the shadows that are real.
But they do know that each other are there because they play this game about who can identify the shadow first. So they know each other are there.
But they
all
it
have
also,
to reread it.
But the
read, it also
oh, did
said,
I, am I missing something?
They, no, but it, that's true. They also said they can't discern with the echo if sound is coming from outside, inside, or
right.
here. So there is an illusion or a delusion to that as well. Yes, but they can't turn their heads.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's looking straight on one way of thinking, one idea.
In the back, with the orange.
Yeah, the thought occurred that the Platonic line of thinking is very different from the Aristotelian or Socratic even, in that Plato emphasized the need to have certain fundamental ideas with which to judge whatever perceptions we can draw from our conditions. So what would be some of the basic ideas that we could use as we move through life? Things that Plato would agree with.
Well, certainly one of them, which was one of the tests, once the individual is freed, he is tested on, does he view the universe as a unity? That's step one. Because holding to that will carry one through the challenges when he goes back down into the cave.
Mm-hmm. And man, it is within man's nature to share, to be just, to seek to balance as nature does. And Plato said if they were encouraged in their quest for truth, they must share the fruits of their vision with their fellow men. So it is part of our nature to seek to make this all better.
And if it is part of our nature to seek to make this all better, perhaps we all will go independently and seek out one more of those ideas that Plato would agree with, because our class is over in 10 seconds. Go.
The three fundamentals. That would be something that they could use to judge the worthiness of what he was trying to do.
Thank you. right, our class is adjourned.
That's what I started with, the unity of all, and I thought you were going to pick up on that.
And go to the second one. And then I would go to the third one.
Oh, I didn't get it because this was staring at me.
Ah.
Is there one of these over there?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't pick up on that, I'm sorry. Oh, jeez.
Then why didn't you take a drink?
It just, I don't know.